they're able to derive a longer and more sustained sense of enjoyment and happiness and joy from the things they have, from their family, from their job, from their car. A lot of that comes from a sense of gratitude. And instead of immediately trying to go to the next thing, like the people in the world of hunger, people that are in the world of rapture actually kind of feel the sense of gratitude toward these things, that they have these things, and it helps them enjoy a more sustained type of happiness. Now, look, it can, again, the world of rapture is still a delusion because you can lose those things, right? And so the things that bring you the biggest joy could plunge you into the world of hell if you lose them. Somebody dies. I mean, something, it could be something tragic or not, but that does not take away from the fact that the amount, the sustainment, and the level of happiness that you can gain from it because of tremendous sense of gratitude is one of the best ways to extend and enhance the amount of happiness you feel from the things that you have.
Welcome to the Gratitude Podcast on www.georgeandbenta.com, where you'll hear a new story each week that will inspire more gratitude in your own life. Our mission is to inspire 100,000 people to discover how to feel gratitude and live a happy life through the amazing life stories of our successful guests and their actionable tips. And now, the host of our podcast, Georgian Benta.
Hi, Gratitude Seeker. Welcome to a new episode of the Gratitude Podcast. Today with us, we have Ash Eldifraoui, who has built a reputation as a thought leader in clinical, social, and consumer psychology. He recently published his book, The 10 Worlds, The New Psychology of Happiness, which he and his co-author spent over 2 decades researching the answer to this question. What is happiness? After transitioning to a career in marketing, he has held senior positions at companies including Google, McKinsey, Wrigley, GoGo, and currently Redbox. He's been featured in The Economist, Forbes, Bloomberg, Fast Money, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, CNBC, and many, many others. He also co-wrote a television pilot called Sessions that was optioned by DreamWorks Television. Ash lives in Hinsdale, Illinois, with his wife and 2 children. And I'm really happy to have him here because we will talk a lot about what happiness is and how we can enjoy it, all of us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Georgian. That was quite an introduction. I really appreciate it. I'm happy to be here.
My pleasure. My pleasure. So let's get right through to it, right? So how do you define happiness? I'm really curious. I know that in your book, you have a very interesting perspective about happiness and what happiness is. And I'm really curious to see how you define it.
Yeah, so, you know, you mentioned we spent a couple of decades researching the answer to that question. And the hypothesis that emerged early that we then spent a majority of the time proving or disproving was that happiness solely and completely is determined by what your beliefs about what happiness is. So not so much from the things or your events or circumstances, beliefs about what happiness is. And so we actually, you know, starting with literally, you know, examining the millennial of observations from philosophers about this all the way to the most cutting, you know, edge neurological research and then framing it in clinical cases, we think that we actually proved that hypothesis. And not only is happiness based on your beliefs about happiness. Yes, because you could argue that there's as many beliefs about happiness as there are people. Mm-hmm. But we found that if you took all the beliefs individual these people have, they slot into what we call 10 fundamental beliefs about happiness that capture all of them. And that we further argue that 9 of those are actually incorrect if you believe they'll bring you lasting happiness, which we call the 9 core delusions.
Okay, that sounds very interesting. And having read them, I tend to agree with you. Like I found myself in a little bit in each of them somehow. And I know that we, in different parts of our life, we tend to be in one or another, right?
Yes, and so when you say one to the other, what he's referring to is the world. So we basically argue that these beliefs are so powerful and so fundamental that they actually create different sort of life states or life conditions, we call them, which is really the coming together of your thoughts, your beliefs, your energy, all the things that make up your inner life state, which we then call the worlds, life conditions or worlds, and that the 10 beliefs form 10 fundamental worlds. And yes, we can move in and out of different ones, and we can actually experience that those different beliefs at different times. But we argue that each of us have a tendency or a one belief that we tend to come back to the most, which is our core life tendency, and that's so to speak the world in which we come from. But we definitely can enter all the other ones at different times.
Yeah, and how does that work? Like, are we born happy or unhappy? Do we learn this?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? Because the whole debate of nature versus nurture has gone on forever. When I was studying psychology, it was really at its apex in terms of nature versus nurture. What I can come to tell you is that I don't think that there's one right answer. I think that genetics and your situations and your environment and your culture all play a role in how it forms. You know, in this book, we basically, have 10 clinical cases in which we examine each of these worlds through somebody's experience and through trying to work to understand that belief. And what became clear in each of those is that, us trying to uncover the reasons people held on to certain beliefs, in each different case is different. Some of them were from traumatic experiences. Some of them were from upbringing. Some of them seem to be just hardwired into people. So it really, depends on so many different things. But at the end of the day, that helps to understand that, I think it's more important to recognize that belief in yourself and ask yourself whether it's actually serving you well or not, so you can examine it. And if you're hanging on to it really hard, there's certain belief very hard, which means that for you it kind of gets activated all the time, then maybe you do need to start really examining what's going on, and maybe in examining it you uncover something that helps you free yourself of it, which is kind of what people do in therapy, for example.
Actually, you anticipated one of my questions, like, how can we change our beliefs? Because we have some beliefs that indeed protect us and somehow keep us away from happiness. And it's important to know what we can do about them, because living in any of the 9 worlds that you mention in the book isn't ideal for any of us, right?
Yeah, well, I can give you my example. So I come from the world of tranquility. And the world of tranquility, the core belief of that world is that happiness comes from avoiding pain, and primarily emotional pain. Now, I actually did not think that's the world I came from when I started writing this book. I actually believe that I came from a world called the world of learning, or the world of realization, which is much more about happiness being derived from personal growth. And that's the case of the world of realization, or happiness comes from creating value or meaning in the world, which is the world of learning. That's what I was hoping. But it turns out when I really examined myself, the world of tranquility is really about the world of seeking peace of mind and seeking security and really being governed by, that need in your life. And so, as you can imagine, spending a life trying to seek sort of peace of mind by controlling, trying to avoid negative outcomes or being conservative is really a fruitless effort, because bad things happen. You face these decisions all the time, and you worry so much about making the wrong decision because you think if you make the wrong decision, then that's going to make me unhappy and my peace of mind goes away. And so you're sort of, I realized that was really, in some ways it was serving me well, because I didn't make impulsive decisions. I wasn't really a pleasure seeker. I didn't take risks, unnecessary risks. I was pretty conservative. But I also, what was really not serving me well was the amount of anxiety and stress it was causing me when I faced any kind of like major life decision, or even small decisions, like which job should I take? Should we move? Should I get married? Should we have kids? Should they go to school? Like every one of those things, I was under the delusion that if I didn't get it right, that my happiness was dependent on it, which is not true. So any of these worlds, in some ways it can serve you well, in some ways it doesn't. Now, the way I've been able to actually, free myself to something, now that I actually understand that and have examined it, I find myself a lot freer of it. When I start feeling this anxiety or feeling this stuff, I start reminding myself that this is actually a delusion or belief that is fundamentally just not true and governing me. And it's really helped me. I mean, obviously it doesn't solve the issue, and I haven't really tried to explore, oh, that's not true. I've explored why I think that's the case for me. But it's given me a lot of power over it, just to be able to reflect and observe it and see whether it served me well or not over the past. So the first thing is to identify the belief, bring it to your conscious mind, and then start asking yourself, how has this served me well or not? And has it helped? Has it ended up being true? Have I really gained happiness from this belief? And I think most people realize that they haven't.
That's so interesting. And I actually found something that they... In your book that I didn't think that I had inside of me. And it has to do with the emotion of anger.
Yes.
And it's very interesting that it's not what you would think. Like, it says something like, people trapped in the world of anger are obsessively concerned about being viewed...
Positively by others,
by others in any way. And that I thought that was so interesting, that some anger that's inside gets out in this way. Like, you would think that only people that are expressing the anger actually have it, you know. And I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah, the world of anger is a really interesting world, because people, when they first hear the world, they think about it as somebody who expresses a lot of anger. But in fact, that's not the case. The world of anger is really the world of sort of insecurity and ego. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you know, some of the greatest people in the world, some greatest CEOs, inventors, so on, have come from the world of anger, because they've been fueled by an insecurity or some need to come drive to achieve or overcome. You know, that we've heard all these cliches about the chip on their shoulder. Or what have you. Great athletes, right, have been driven by this need to be the best. Mm-hmm. And so some part you have to come from this world in some ways to achieve great things. However, as you can imagine, the negative manifestations of this are pretty epic. And I used to see a lot of these, because this is also the world of jealousy, the world of rage, the world of need to control others, the world of philandering, the world of, you know, unnecessary competitive nature. There's different negative manifestations, and that the reality is insecurity and ego is really anger toward inward. And we kind of examine in the book why usually that insecurity, that feeling like small, and the need to make yourself feel bigger than others by making others feel small, is rooted in this idea of the self-loathing or self-anger you have towards yourself. And only when you free yourself from that can you sort of move on and gain a grip on this world. And it sometimes does manifest itself in anger, but it's not fundamentally how you always see it.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. And another thing about this that I thought was also quite fascinating was the fact that anger can disguise itself as exaggerated benevolence.
Yes. I mean, and so you think about... you know, it's this kind of false grinning, or, you know, we've all talked about it in a way. Yes, it could actually come across as a way of sort of ingratiating yourself in this way that's not really genuine, but it's in essence a way to sort of control or manage or feel superior to others. But it manifests itself in a very different way. So it's absolutely right. It's not what it seems, because what's under the surface is not at all what's actually bubbling up to the top.
Yeah, I thought that was so interesting that. I didn't see myself as an angry person, but if I look a little bit more, a little bit deeper inside, I can trace some anger, and I am guessing that there is some anger that isn't is not put out there, and it's not dealt with maybe in a healthy way. And it's very interesting, because I thought that if I am, for instance, benevolent, that means that I'm just a good person. But the many things that make me angry, I'm not expressing. And that doesn't mean that the anger doesn't exist. And that I thought was very interesting.
That's great. That's amazing. I'm George. I'm so happy that it's helped you self-reflect, because anger is one of the most commonly suppressed emotions human beings know how to kind of bury. But it, you know, and we're very good at it because it's not always appropriate to demonstrate. But everybody experiences it and feels it in some way. So you just have to understand exactly what you're examining and what roles are playing in your life. And so that's great.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that what I feel and what I understand from this is that some behaviors and some beliefs can, if we understand what's behind them, like if I know that I'm maybe exaggeratedly benevolent comes from anger, if I do something about the anger, I get to be more balanced. And yeah. I don't need to be that benevolent, like to exaggerate, you know? And I think this is very interesting. And I'm sure that our listeners can relate as well. Like we do some things, like we exaggerate with some things that may come from insecurities. But even behind those insecurities, we have something. Like it might be anger or shame or other things that are inside of us, right?
Absolutely. And it's you really articulated it well, Jordan, in terms of, and that's even better than I did in terms of, you know, examining disbelief or something that highlights something greater. So another, for example, another common world, a very common world, is the world of hunger. It's in terms of the research we've done, it's one of the more common worlds, particularly for people who are a little younger. And that is that to be happy, we have to get what we want. Yeah. Now that sounds kind of obvious. It sounds like, you know, of course, you do. And before I get into the specific kind of way to examine this world, I think that that's the perfect world to talk about an important concept. And that is that these beliefs do lead to happiness and they do lead to feeling of joy. That's a very real feeling. The problem is that it's a happiness that's very fragile because ultimately it won't last. It's sort of like, we call it like a stick, chewing a stick of gum, right? It's very sweet at first, but there's all kinds of psychological, neurological reasons why it fades over time. Mm-hmm. And then we need the next stick of gum and the next stick of gum, right? So, and the world of hunger is a nice example of that one, a very clean example of that one, because with this world, everybody enters this world all the time. I enter it all the time. And that is this idea that, you know, if I could just have this, I could be happy. I could just get the promotion or that job. Or that girl, or that guy, or that house, or that car, or that whatever it is, and you convince yourself, and you believe that if I can just get that, that'll make me happy. And you get it, and it gives you some joy. But think of how quickly you then move your attention to the next thing that you need, and the next thing that you need. And so, and again, the world of hunger has been, you know, people have pursued great things and accomplished great things for themselves. But if you fundamentally believe this is what you need to be happy, then clearly that's risky, right? Because what if you don't get it?
True.
Then does that mean your happiness, you can't be happy? Well, that's what the belief would tell you, right? And so this is the world of, you know, this can plunge you into the world of hell as much as it can plunge you into a sense of pleasure or happiness. Because fundamentally, you'll eventually lose some of those things, right? You may lose the job that you get. You might get, you know, dumped by the, you know, the significant other that you find. Mm-hmm. Something tragic might happen. You know, you might lose your money. The market goes down, whatever it is. But if you place your happiness in that particular attachment, then you're obviously just as much risk of losing it. And so it's clearly not the answer to how do I have lasting or happiness that lasts.
Definitely, definitely. And I believe that this is where gratitude kicks in.
Like, yeah.
I'll let you continue with this then.
No. That's exactly where gratitude comes in. That was so funny you'd say that. Because if you think about, I think gratitude kicks in nicely in the world of rapture, which is kind of the mid world where it's the belief that your happiness comes from a specific attachment. But let me tell you the difference between, for example, the world of rapture and the world of hunger, while there's other sort of differences, to me, the key difference actually does lie in gratitude. And I didn't think about that, Georgian, until I started reading a little bit and watching some of your podcast. Because the reason people, the world of rapture has a lot of joy in it, because people from the world of rapture do a better job than anybody in the lower world of kind of gaining happiness from the things they have.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to derive a longer and more sustained sense of enjoyment and happiness and joy from the things they have, from their family, from their job, from their car, you know, whatever. And a lot of that comes from a sense of gratitude. And recognize, and instead of immediately trying to go to the next thing, like the people in the world of hunger, people that are in the world of rapture actually kind of feel the sense of gratitude toward these things, that they have these things, and it helps them enjoy a more sustained type of happiness. Now, look, it can, again, the world of rapture is still a delusion because you can lose those things, right? And so the things that bring you the biggest joy could plunge you into the world of hell if you lose them. Somebody dies. I mean, something, it could be something tragic or not, but that does not take away from the fact that the amount sustained and the level of happiness that you can gain from it because of tremendous sense of gratitude is one of the best ways to extend and enhance the amount of happiness you feel from the things that you have.
Definitely, definitely. And in my experience, and just by talking with more than 100 people about gratitude, one of the things that I've seen gratitude do for people is that it actually changes the beliefs, you know, the way we see what we experienced. And sometimes even experiences that were very traumatic, the fact that they were able to use gratitude constantly to change the beliefs about what happened actually helped people quite a lot to move on and to get to happiness.
And that fits very nicely with our model here, because the more you can experience, you know, at the end of the day, there's a commonality between all nine worlds and all beliefs and all of these beliefs. And that is that at the core, the delusion that underlies all of them is that your happiness comes from some type of attachment, right? Now, when we think about attachment, we often, the first thing that comes to mind is something, a physical attachment. But the reality is, if you look at each of these worlds, some of them are come from attachments to physical things. Some of them come from attachment to pleasure seeking, like the world of animality. So it's an attachment to pleasure and seeking pleasure through sex, drugs, rock and roll, all that stuff. Some of it comes from the attachment to achieving things. We talked about the attachment to avoiding pain, or attachment to our own ego. Once you start getting into the higher worlds, they seem like they're better attachments qualitatively, like the belief that I have to create something meaningful, or that I have to grow, or I have to commit myself to the happiness of others. Those are still attachments to something, form something that you need to accomplish or achieve or do or feel or experience, or other people to feel. And so what I think gratitude does is allow us to shift our kind of beliefs about these attachments, hang on to them or view them in a slightly different way, and allows us to enhance the amount of happiness we can gain from them. So it's kind of like a catalyst almost. It's like an enhancer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have this overwhelming sense of gratitude, by the way, the gratitude is one of the things we talk about in the world of enlightenment, which is the highest world, the 10th world. Because in a sense, it's a gateway to being able to experience a sense of kind of awe, and which we've read that enlightenment is the life condition of awe, the experience of awe. And so I think gratitude fundamentally can transform every one of these beliefs into a slightly different and better and more enduring type of happiness.
Yeah, definitely. And since you mentioned the last world, can you tell us a little bit about it? And I will have a question about it afterwards.
Sure. So the life condition of enlightenment, which is what we call the life condition of awe, unlike all the other worlds that are based on attachment to something, the life condition of enlightenment is really about perceiving the world in a different way. So it's not about deriving happiness from something. It's about perceiving the world in a particular way. And if you can, and we argue that the entryway into that is to be able to generate a sense of awe. Now we go into a lot of this because I think people have thought about enlightenment as this sort of thing for Buddhist monks in Tibet, and in reality, that's not at all how we see this, and it's not a mystical thing that's not available to everybody. We actually spent a lot of time in the book talking about how this is a very, very much a neurological phenomenon that has been studied, and everybody who's reported these awakening moments or these experiences of enlightenment have all described it the same way over, you know, hundreds of years across all different cultures. But the key belief to it is to be able to see the world and experience the world in this, you know, maybe think about it as this kind of childlike awe. Like, think about the way kids sort of view everything in the world as kind of new and exciting and amazing. Mm-hmm. And think how hard it is for adults to sort of, you know, generate that. Very hard for us to see the world in that way. But if you can capture that and sort of bottle it and understand how to experience that, then we believe that's gonna result in a type of happiness that is indestructible, absolute, and can't be destroyed by anything that happens to you or any different, losing any types of attachments. Now, that's not to say that you don't experience pain and joy and all those things. That's absolutely there. This is not about some transient state where you're kind of in this meditative state. In fact, the difference between this and all kinds of things through meditation and flow and all those other concepts are, in the world of enlightenment, there's not this suppression of you know, your consciousness. You're fully there and alert, and you're operating in, you know, like anybody else that's walking around. But the way you kind of view the world and the way you experience all these different things is transformed, in that you don't really suffer. The things don't cause this tremendous amount of suffering. You know, you experience pain, you experience joy, you cry, whatever, but you don't really fundamentally suffer to the point where your happiness is kind of is diluted.
That's very interesting. And you actually anticipated my question, because I was curious. So when you get to that level, like, you still have challenges. Like, I've talked with people that are like spiritual leaders or CEOs or multimillionaires, and they still have problems even if they are successful or they have reached a certain level from different points of view. So how do these kinds of people that are at that level react to the problems that they have or might have?
When you say somebody who is, you believe, in the world of enlightenment, you mean?
Yeah.
The way you would experience those things are, they sort of are transformed from things that cause you suffering to things that cause you pain, but fundamentally don't diminish the happiness you're feeling. Maybe you see them, things, great losses as opportunities. So, for example, you know, it's not uncommon that, think about the fact that you could have the exact same thing happen to different people. I saw this all the time as a therapist. For one person, it could really destroy them and send them into the world of suffering. How, like, somebody loses a spouse or loses a job. For one person, it destroys them and they get depressed. There's anxiety, there's panic. They don't know what they're going to do, and it destroys them. For others, the exact same event can trigger a sense of, wow, I can get a better job. I really hated that. That guy was tyrannical. That was holding me back. Like, it's freeing for them. Mm-hmm. Same thing with somebody who loses a significant other. For some people, it destroys them. Alex tells the story in our book about, you know, that was his first entry into the world of hell, and the world of enlightenment for him when he lost, you know, his first love sort of ended. Well, for other people, that experience could lead them to a tremendous amount of self-examination, in terms of themselves, or how they can become better, or what does it tell them about myself, or why did this end, or why did this person leave me, and it frees them to become better and grow. Well, why? Why would one person, and that comes from, you know, a different beliefs and mindsets that they have, and the world of enlightenment is fundamentally about the world where, you know, all the everything that happens, it's not about not feeling pain, but it doesn't cause you to suffer, and you're able to see it as an opportunity for something, for even greater happiness, rather than it plunging you into the world of hell.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. And do you believe that we can get there? Like, is it a world that's possible for everyone?
Yes, we do. And when you read about it in the chapter, you see that there's all kinds of interesting different ways in which just over time people have sort of entered this state. Clearly, it's a hard state to maintain, and it requires us to kind of work and practice. And there's still a lot of research to be done on it. But I believe it is a true neurological, psychological state that is available to everybody.
Mm-hmm. And what could we do to get there? Like, what are some steps that could lead us to that world?
Well, so we do talk in there about a few different things to try, and like even meditation and things like that could, but what I do is make a real conscious effort to try to kind of find awe in different things around you, and don't take them for granted. There is a lot of research that shows that there's a lot of things in nature that induce a sense of awe, and it's one of the most common triggers. Things that are like the Grand Canyon, or even just in the drop of water. But I think that you're trying to focus your mind, your attention, and give yourself the time to try to find sort of the beauty in the world, and try to induce that sense of awe for yourself, and just practice it and see if you're able to sort of release yourself from, you know, all the things that are burdening you, or all the different ways which you think you've seen these things, and try to see them in a different way. Is one way that you can try to just practice trying to enter, get yourself to experience that more and more. So for me, just try to figure out how you can induce a sense of awe in different things more and more and more. And the better you get at that, the more you'll find yourself able to sort of free yourself of other beliefs to kind of weigh you down.
Beautiful. And it actually reminded me of my own experience, like how I got to create this podcast. And it was very similar. So the words were very similar to what you were saying a few minutes ago. Like what I felt when I first experienced what I interpreted as being like a wave of gratitude was that I was experiencing everything that I was seeing around me like it was new. Like it was the first time when I moved to the city where I live in, the first time when I went to the apartment where I lived, and the pet that I had, like I felt the kind of appreciation and awe for it, like I felt the first time that I got it. And I totally resonate with that, and I think it's something very similar.
And by the way, just to drive that point home, I think trying to experience, I think gratitude is another way into this. And I think spending time trying to hang on or enjoy or reflect on the things that you have, rather than things you're trying to achieve, and what are the ways that you can gain more enjoyment out of that or see it differently. I mean, one trick they talk about is, you know, try to take your mind and imagine kind of losing some of those things. And doing so, and take yourself there, and that will help you kind of gain a more of a sense of gratitude for the things that you do have. That sounds like a simple trick, but it actually works very well. And so it's not just about finding awe in nature and those things. It's about maybe experiencing more gratitude for the things that you have, taking the time to slow down and consider that, and consider, you know, what belief that you are functioning under that's taking your attention away from feeling gratitude. Because, you know, one of the key reasons that people that enjoyment does not last, if you read our book, we talk a lot about this. The reason the enjoyment and happiness does not last from all these different attachments, literally it sounds simplistic, is that our attention is pulled away from them. And so, you know, when you're trying to achieve something like the world of hunger, you're fixated on it. You're obsessed. It's occupying your time all the time. And so you're convinced that this thing is going to, I need this. And so it gets your attention. When you get it, you step 10, you're just literally, you pay less attention to it. And so, you know, and so I think part of it is it's attention. Like, give attention to the things that you have, focus on them, you know, and it's a, and remind yourself, you know, and try to generate that sense of awe and gratitude, in those things more and more and more. And that will, I think, will help you also, you know, be less gripped by some of these other delusions.
Yeah, I love that. But to be honest, I haven't been able to do this exercise with imagining how it would be without different things. Like, I get scared a little bit about this, to be honest. Like, it's really at the edge of my comfort zone somehow.
Yeah, no, so I know exactly what you're talking about. I know exactly what you're talking about. But that's actually, but it's in that uncomfort first of all, think about sometimes why you might get emotional. If you think about losing your greatest thing, if you think about like what it would be like if something happened to my wife or my kids, it's tough, right? You can even start getting emotional. Like literally, I've come to tears thinking about that.
Yeah, I know.
I'll admit it. But honestly, it was powerful. Because of that, I mean, just imagine, just because of the thought of it can bring you to that kind of emotion or even a lack of comfort with it. That's a great way to generate why exactly you should feel a tremendous amount of gratitude. Because the power, you know, the emotion, the fact that you can't even confront the emotion of losing it should be the, you know, the exact reason why you should derive that much gratitude from the things that you do have. So it's so nice that you would sort of reveal that. And then you got me to say that. So it's in those difficult little emotional tricks that you see the power of your beliefs have over you, and the power that you have to change them if you want.
Yeah. And another thing that happened right now, I was trying to do that again with you. And it was so interesting that it actually got me to experience that emotion. Like, it got me to feel it more and to not just think about the thing that I appreciate about a certain person, but to actually feel, you know, like it was something much deeper, and it's so interesting. Yeah, thank you for doing this with me.
Sure, this was great.
Yeah, so we're nearing the end of our time together, and I wanted to ask you, where can our audience find your book?
So a couple of things. So first of all, if you want to quickly find out what world you might come from, we have a little self-assessment you can do that takes like 3 minutes.
Great.
Yeah, if you go to the10worlds.com, there's a tab that says assessment. If you go there, it will take you through like 20 questions, and it will tell you what world we think you come from. It's been a very interesting exercise when people do that. It's been very illuminating. And if you go there, we can also link to the book. But of course, it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and sort of where all books, you know, are sold. You can grab it. You can grab it anywhere. It's pretty much on all in all online bookstores.
Awesome. Awesome. So thank you so much for being here with us. The book, once again, if you want to search for it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, it's The 10 Worlds, The New Psychology of Happiness. Thank you so much, Ash, for being here with us. And if you have a final message for our listeners.
No, thanks for letting me be here. Our goal in this is to have everybody be able to pursue and live happier lives that are and experience a happiness that's more enduring. So that's our mission. And I'm glad you're helping us spread the word.
Definitely. My pleasure. My pleasure.
Thanks,
Georgian. Hey, Gratitude Seeker. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this interview. I really appreciate it. And if you could think of one person that would also benefit from it, share it with them. It might actually be the inspiration that they need to make their day or maybe even their life much better. Thank you so much once again. This has been Georgian Benta. Don't forget to keep seeking and spreading gratitude.